Welcome to the Sourdough Speak, the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the Great Gold Stampedes at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdough Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Among the pioneers of Alaska living in Fairbanks, one of the best known is Lively Clara Rust, who was 81 years young at the time of interview in 1971. Clara came to Fairbanks in 1908 at the age of 18 to join her parents. That summer in Seattle, Clara received word from her family that she was to sail north immediately, first to St. Michael's, then to take a river steamer up the Yukon and Tanana Rivers to Fairbanks. In this broadcast of the Sourdough Speak, it will be impossible to tell the fascinating story of Mrs. Rust's life. At present, she is finishing the manuscript of her autobiography, but we'll focus on some of those aspects of early day interior Alaska that are seldom written about or talked about. Because of early employment in a woman's dress shop, Mrs. Rust was required to pay business calls in a part of the town that few women who, in those days, were called ladies, visited. So it is an unusual opportunity to learn about what are euphemistically called houses of joy from the viewpoint of a very warm and a very proper pioneer lady of Fairbanks. We also talk about early Daytona, the town that almost put Fairbanks out of business, but whose early remnants have now disappeared into the course of the Chena River. But here is Clara to tell her story, beginning with her arrival.
We accepted the town of Chena. The first day I saw the town of Chena was about 5 o'clock at night when we came up. And, you know, I always had the idea, because at that time there was kind of snow ice on the river, and I figured that, near as I could figure, about the time I came up here was around October the 5th. But when I was writing this story for the Alaska Journal, Bob Henning was looking up that paper. He found where Mr. Hickman had arrived in Fairbanks on September the 27th, 1908. So I evidently arrived here on September the 27th. In 1908, instead of October the 5th, as I always thought I had. But I remember the morning that we landed here in Fairbanks, there had been a little snow that night, and there was what I thought was what you call shore ice, but it must have been just the snow collected on it. It might have been a little ice on the edge of the river when they landed down below town here in a rowboat, you know. But you asked about the town of Chena. When our boat got up there, we had transferred from the Susie at Tanana to the Seabrook Tanana, and to go up the Tanana River. And when we got to the little town of Chena, why, the river was so low, and a boat had come down, and they said, well, you'll never make it, because the river is so low. You'd better send your passengers and your freight up on the train, because you had the little train running down there, a little narrow gauge train. And so they talked it over, and they figured out that they kept us there all night, because our fare was paid from Seattle to Fairbanks. All paid, we didn't have to pay for anything in between time. So they would have to pay our fare on the train and to keep us at the hotel all night to send up. There's only another woman and myself and about eight, ten men. That was all that was on this last boat coming up. And so we decided it would be cheaper to transfer us to a smaller boat and send us up. So the Reliance was there, and they transferred us to the Reliance. Not our luggage. Our luggage were kept on the channel and everything. So they put us on the Reliance, Elston Wheeler.
And it plied the water from Fairbanks to Chena?
They went through down there up to St. Michael, no, but really, the Reliance was a little boat that was supposed to be the exclusive for the lumber company. It was built for it wasn't the Reliance, it was the Idler that was built for the lumber company. But it was built by a private concern for private, it wasn't one of the steamship companies. And that was its maiden voyage that year. It came up to St. Michael same time we did. And it was up here ahead of us, because we had transferred so much and had to stop to unload all the way up the river. You know, we'd unload the last boat of the season, so there was lots of supplies. Winter supplies would be loaded. They had a little village that was stuck there. And when we got up here to the Tanana, then they transferred to the steamer Tanana, and then, we went through snowstorms and everything going up the Tanana to get to the town of Chena. So we got about 5 that night, and it was kind of dusk, and it wasn't very warm out, and so they decided to put us on board the little Reliance, so they did. And we just got within, just around the, not even around the bend from the town of Chena, when We did it on a sandbar, and we hung there. And while we were there, this Kananov goes by us over at the bank. Now, I don't know, our captain didn't know what he was doing or what, but here we were hung up on this sandbar. And there had been a big mill at the time there, and the miller dumped sawdust in there, and maybe they had hit that sawdust or something, because anyway, we were hung up there for hours. And
in 1908, they had a sawmill.
Oh, yes, there were sawmills all over. There was a sawmill down in Chena. Now, you asked about Chena. There was a big sawmill there, and they had docks. There were docks that went built on the edge of the river, just like we had up here at Fairbanks, for big warehouses on those docks. And what you call the Chena Ridge now, and where they can show you part of the stamp mill base there, the way out in front of that, really, the when you travel this little boat of the pioneers, Mr. Jim Binkley, why, you're about where the town edge came to, because these rivers, like the Tamara, they cut on one side and fill up on the other, and they had cut out. The whole town's practically all gone. In fact, they all cut out.
The river
has cut out the town, you see, because where you go up on the Chena Ridge there, that was the back part of the town. That was way out there. The town came way out, and there was these big warehouses there. There was Turkey stores, and they even had a little row like they had the dance hall girls, and the girl's name was Lou, and they had a street for them, and there were several churches, and it was really a good-sized town. The first day I got to Fairbanks, I got in, I put it on the shore in rowboats, you know, and about half past five in the morning, and my sister and I walked up the house, and then after resting, we went uptown. And my mother, we dropped into this dry goods store. It's called Mary Anderson's Dry Goods Store. And she had kind of a leaf store. She sold the best furs and hats, the big hats and all that stuff. And so while my mother was making a few purchases, she happened to say to her, you're not in need of a good husky girl, are you? Because the minute I landed here, my father started looking for a job. He told me his places. He'd been to the telephone office places to line up jobs for me. Why, he said to Miss Anderson, you wouldn't by any chance need a good husky girl because Clara is looking for a job. And she said, had you ever clerked in a store before? And I said, no. I had clerked in a little bakery and a lunch kind of deal where they sold ice cream and stuff. And I said, I had run a cash register. I know how to run a cash register. And she said, well, that's all I need to know. She said, do you think you'd like to work in a dry goods store? And I said, well, I never have. But she was the cutest little blonde thing, you know, little petite little thing. And I kind of liked her looks. And I said, well, I'd be willing to try. So, she said, we'll come to work Monday morning. So here I had, you know, got a job right away. Well, then as the time wore on, I began to realize, you know, see these funny girls coming in and were acting funny. But you know, those girls on the line, where they went on the street, you'd never hardly accept they'd be overdressed sometimes with more clothes on or bigger plumes in their hats and better furs and things. But they never exposed themselves. They gave a dance here one year, and everybody went expecting to see a lot of sights. Those girls were dressed in the most beautiful evening dresses, and most of them, they very seldom saw their bosoms, their arms were covered, and they never exposed themselves forever. They only exposed themselves when they were working. You see them now coming out, these can-can girls and stuff like that. They never played around like that. You never saw them except if you went to a show where they're performing or something like that. They never exposed themselves. And so they were coming to the store to shop, but they did an awful lot of embroidery work. They had the silk cloth, you know, always buying fancy pillows. Because they'd have their beds, all just beautiful pillows laid up, you know, laid on the beds and all, make their workbenches, I guess what you'd call it, just the fancies they can make with all these fancy pillows. And they'd have drapes, and then when they'd have a live one, they'd call them in while they'd shut themselves in this bed deal. So anyway, I'll recall Mrs. Anderson. She said, Mary, she says, I've got a live one tonight. She said, can I bring him over? And she said, I'd like for him to look at the coats or something like that. So Mary would stay open, and quite often I had to go back at night, especially one of these nights. I'd go back to help her because Mary Ann would be bringing on them. I'd have to bring the clothes out and put them away again because she would take them in her apartment that's attached to the store. And so I would come into the store and get the coats or whatever she wanted and take them in for the girl try on and take back again. So I was kind of a greenhorn. I was wide-eyed and taking all this in, you know, and I began to absorb what this line was and what the girls were doing. And so anyway, she would wait on them, you know, and then the girls would sell their clothes. Then sometimes the girls would say, well, I have a live one. I can't come over. Would you send some things over to me? And of course, Mary Ann wanted to make a sale, so she'd load me up with these things, and I'd have to scoot down Fifth Avenue. She was right on the corner of Fifth and Christensen store. I'd skip down, and then where this fast track building is, there's a little alleyway, and I slipped in back there to get to the back door of some of these girls' place. And so she'd leave the light on for me, and I would carry these armful of posts and take them down there. And sometimes I would wait for the girl and help her try them on. And then again, I would leave them and then have to go back later after the close. And when my mother and father heard about these trips of mine, oh, they were there. I was going to have to quit work because they didn't want it at all. And I told them, well, gosh, I said, I know all about it now, and they don't rub up off on me, and I like my job, and why should I change job just for that? Well, don't tell anybody. I said, boy, what do people think? I said, I don't care what people think. I know I'm doing what's right. And the same way on the street, there was this one girl, Edith Neal. She is well known, and she's the one that they said saved the Nanana during the flu epidemic, you know. She was a tall, straight, and a very attractive woman.
And when was the flu epidemic?
It was in 1918, during the World War I. And it almost wiped out the town of Nanana, and she was angel mercy, where everybody would shut themselves in and lock their doors and die. She went around, and she saved dozens of people down there. And people to this day will talk about Edith and being saved in town now because she was just wonderful. She just worked herself to bone. But anyway, she would be on the street, you know, and I spoke to her. I said, oh, hello, Edith, how are you? And I'd be going to the bank for Mary Ann or something like that, and I'd pass in. She'd look at me, you know, and kind of draw back and kind of smile and go on, and I thought, gee, that's funny. So one day she was in the store and said, listen here, girl, she said, you're going to ruin your reputation by speaking to me on the street. I said, how come? I said, I talk to you and wait on me in the store. Why can't I speak to you on the street? Well, she said, if anybody sees it, she says, you knowing who I am, she said, they'll think that we're friends or something, and it might not be too good for your reputation. I said, any time I see you on the street, I'm going to speak to you. You're always a lady with me, and I like waiting on any time you're good enough to wait on. You're good enough to speak on the street. And so that's the way she was, you know. So you see, the girls were kind of modest again in their one way, where they exposed themselves and did this work in the other way, you know.
Did you get to know any of them? And in her case, did you become fairly personal?
Oh, yes. There was another one. Her name was, we called her High Pocket. She later married a man that had the, she was so tall, long-legged, and they called her High Pocket. And I got to know her real well because after she married Mr. B, I didn't know how she was working too much except having waited on her in the store. But she married this Mr. and he belonged to the Eagles Lodge. And we had a little ladies' club we called the Eagles Ladies' Club, and he brought her there. And we thought, well, he's an eagle, and so we had, she was okay then. She was helping, she was living a good life, and she was helping run his hotel. So we took her in, and we were all very friendly. Got to know her, and she was a hard worker. She used strong language and all, but she turned out to be a fine woman. Very fine. She was all respected mostly by everybody after that. Uh-huh. So you see, you do. Quite a few of them did marry and become real respectable people here, and she's the one I was closest associated with. Then one day there was a pretty blonde girl, I can't remember what her name was. She had moved on the line, she was fairly new, but being blonde and all, why, she was the new girl there, and she had the run of the men all over after her, you see, because she was new and beautiful. Then there was this one girl called Georgia Lee. And she sat in business over in Lavendon. She moved over in Lavendon. She had a cabin with him over there while his wife was in his service. So anyhow, she got jealous. This girl had bought all these beautiful clothes, hats with great big plumes on, you know, and all this. And this one day, this girl came over to Mary's and crying, and she had these dresses and ribbons and stuff. And this Georgia Lee had gone in one day when she was away, and she had cut all these brand new clothes. She had cut those beautiful $30-$40 plumes, these big little plumes, the big long songs. She had cut them in little inch pieces. She had torn just turned to ribbons, all those clothes. And they almost had, I guess they had kind of a battle, and I guess they, finally when this girl met up with her, why they had a hair pulling match, and the police had to separate
them. Well,
I
guess they had a community all of their own.
They did. They had a community all their own over there. Yes, that's right.
And how many were there?
Oh, let's see, it must have been 20, 30. Well, it must have been 20, 30, because between Cushman and Barnett, and they were just all the way through there. I don't think there's any state in the world that ever had a thing like this line that's here in Fairbanks, you see. They had fenced off, they had a big board, high board fence between, on Cushman Street, between, on 4th Avenue, crossing 4th Avenue, a big high board fence. And on each side, and then they had gates that would open, like the waterman or the little boy go in, they would drive in and close the gate after them. They'd open the gate and drive in and close the gate after them. And then on each side where there'd be a sidewalk, like a sidewalk going down on each side of 4th Avenue, why, there was like a, I don't know what you call it, but there's a board there. You're going behind the board another way, kind of zigzag to get in there, so people couldn't see a man going in there. They couldn't see in there when the man went in. I can explain that rightly, you know. You would, there's a walk here, then there's a little place behind here where you step in behind the wall, you see, and then another little kind of L deal to go in, for the men to go in there.
Going in would not see the men going out.
Not necessarily that. It's so the people on Cushman Street couldn't see into there when they went in. Uh-huh. And then several of them, the girls there, they had little alleyways where you could go in off of 3rd Avenue in between some cabins up to their place, or you can go from 5th Avenue in between to get in there too, if you wanted to be more private and not go in the main entrance. And there was on each side of the street, there was a sidewalk, and there was these little places they called the cribs. And they each had a large window and then the door going in. And some of the girls lived there night and day, but most of them had, they had a boyfriend or a man that they were teaching, you know, and they would live in a little cabin in different parts of town. But some of the girls lived back there, they had larger cabins to live right in their homes. And how I come to know so much of these, my husband had a very, an old friend of his that he'd known ever since in Alaska, and what my husband needed a penny or something, he'd go to him, he'd give it to him, and they'd borrow back and forth, he'd sell his clothes and everything. They were just real good pals. And he had opened up a pool room and a shooting gallery. And this was in 1910 and 11. Of course, the line had been there for years, but this is my first experience, really, to see how it operated. And so anyway, he had a place they called it, old fast track they called it, and he had rented that, and he had put in his pool table and his shooting gallery in there, and then he had living quarters upstairs, and so every once in a while he would want my husband and I come down, he'd like to cook and fool around, he'd have us come down for dinner. And I remember this one night, there was a young girl, Barbara, the first woman, Barbara in Fairbanks, had come in, and he had quite a crazy taste on this Barbara girl, and he'd invited her up for dinner, and my husband had gone, I don't know if he was on a hunting trip or he had to work that night, but anyway, he couldn't go with us. So Frank said, "Clara, you'll just have to come up for dinner, because she won't come without another lady there, that she wouldn't come up with me alone, and she had to have another lady there." So from what I heard about, I was surprised about this too, but maybe she's just playing a game with Frank. Anyway, I said, "Well, I'm going to do the baby." I had the baby then. Wow, this must have been 1912, because I was born in March 1912. I said, "Well, I'm going to do the baby. Well, bring the buggy and bring her down." And so I did, and he carried the baby buggy upstairs, and she was there. Then they had so many of these stores and people, they had the bay windows, you know. So there were two bay windows here. And so we sat in these bay windows, and we watched the proceedings down below here. We could just see the whole works. And so the men would come along, you know, and there'd be a girl sitting in the window, and they'd have their perfectly naked, you know. They would lay their back open, you know, and smoking, and they'd waiting to come in, and oh yes, it's hard to believe. I didn't dare put that in the book, you know, and I blushed, and I felt so, well, knowing Frank like I did and all, but we got a big kick out of watching that there, you know, and as Frank would point out, would be some businessman, some married man would be come down, oh, he's a frequent visitor there, and so it was comical, and then the girls would get out on the sidewalk, you know, and they make a little dance in front of their place. They'd give a little dance and to get the fellows to come in. And it's really a show all itself. And later on, I remember watching a crane one night dancing to his mates, you know, and I was thinking about these women, how even the birds, how they dance.
Most of the girls worked independently then. We wondered if there were any houses where several girls worked as for a madam.
There was the one place for the fast track. Come over where it came into 4th Avenue. It had a kind of like a store entrance. I think there maybe at one time had a little restaurant in there. And at one time, that had been a building for a madam. This woman had girls there, and she was the madam. And they had a dance floor, and they had, I remember, Henty, I think the fellow's name was, a little funny little fellow that played the piano for them, and he played the piano, and this was a little place all of its own, this fast track in there. And so that was the only spot where they weren't in, and that would be maybe taking about 3 of the cribs, maybe 4 of the cribs there. There was a two-story, a story and a half frame building right in there, and it was between 4th and 5th Avenue, had an entrance on 5th, an entrance on 4th. So it's hard to believe all these things happened. And then when I first came to Fairbanks, right at the corner of Forrest and Cushman, where Penny's had their store, and right on that corner was the big Flora Door dance hall. That was right there. The Flora Door was right on that corner.
Now, was that connected to the...
To this line, yes. You could go out the back door or bring out the back door of the Flora Door onto the line there, because it was right there, right on the corner. But they closed down in the spring of 1909. It was closed down, so I didn't have too much experience with the Flora Door. But you'd go down Cushman, you would hear all the music and everything in there, and that was the Flora Door dance
hall. Well, now, the City Hall today is built between 4th and
5th. It's built on the corner of 5th, right on the corner of 5th, the City Hall. But the old City Hall was at the end of Turner Street. It was on 3rd Avenue, the end of Turner. Turner didn't go through like it does now up to
But I'm wondering where the City Hall is today. It would have been just about the line.
Well, that would be the back end of the line. The line was on 4th. The line was 4th Avenue.
And it went down to Barnett?
And it went to Barnett. Just the street itself was on both sides of the street, so like it had two sidewalks. And then the buildings on each side of the sidewalk between Cushman to Barnett. But then back of there, well, this fast track did go up to 5th, and there's other little cabins there. There was quite a few private cabins that these girls that lived in. They had these, well, it's not too nice a word, I don't know where the word came from. They called them pimps, men that they kept. The men would go out and wrestle for them, you know. They would go out and they'd meet a man in the bar and take him into his girlfriends, you know. And these girls kept them, they kept them dressed like a millionaires and everything. And to find their whiskey and all that stuff. So they lived with them, some of them, on 5th Avenue. And then some of us up there, they're scattered all over the town, in cabins all over the town. And later on, after they closed the line, there was a lady that tried to run something, the building's gone, right down on 3rd Avenue, along in, about where the disco is, along in there someplace.
Yeah.
There's a woman had a two-story building in there. She tried to run it, but they closed it down, they ran her out. There's a log house, a two-story log house in there.
The people of Fairbanks have always been very proper about the vice in their town.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, it's hard to believe, but in the early days at the dances, nobody, any ill reviewed anything against the room could not go to some of these dances. I know when the Eagles would have their dance, the man at the door, you know, why he would whisper, see somebody come in. For instance, there was a lady here, we used to call her Biddy or something like that, and sometimes she'd be all dolled up and slipping to dance, and if they see her, why, they would ask her to go. And anybody that some man would try to bring one of the girls in, they wouldn't allow them in there. Oh no, they were very, very fussy about who attended. They were snooty. They were a snooty bunch in the early days. That's all there is to it.
It was very definitely a line, social line.
They were the social line.
They
was really. There was a very definite social line between them. And boy, when we went to dances, we all wore long dresses, of course, and some were decollete, or what you call it, low dress. But we always wore gloves to the dancers, and then would either wear gloves or they held a handkerchief at your back so that they wouldn't throw you down, because there was no cleaners to people like there is now, you know. You didn't have the cleaners and stuff then like we have now, and your dress had to be taken care of and lasted.
We wondered then about Jeff Rust, the man Clara married, what he did and how Clara met him.
When I first met my husband, he was prospecting and mining, and then he did hunt for the market too. He went out and hunted sheep. And moose, it was mostly moose because he didn't do much on the caribou, but mostly moose and sheep that he would hunt and sold on the market. And he was doing that when I first met him. He was off on a hunter crossing when I first came to town, because my sister and my mother had met him and his mother and got real friendly with him before I got here, because his mother ran this bathhouse. It's what the Oddfellows Hall now, his mother built. That was a bathhouse and a health clinic. He used to sober up drunks there and had the steam baths, you know, and these men that a lot of the married and lawyers and fellows in town, the prominent men, like, they'd come there to be sobered up.
Now, lots of times, you know, today we associate steam parlors and massage parlors with the illicit type of vice that was on 4th Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them did have that. They had the old Palace Bathhouse over on, used to be on 4th there, that they have out now, the fancy store in Alaska Land. That was the Palace Bathhouse in the early days here. And they had steam baths there, and they had rooms upstairs where men could take girls up there, or they could sleep off their booze or something there. But Mother never allowed any of that at her place, so she would take the men in and sober them, but she never did allow any girls in that kind of work there. But this bathhouse did have, the girls were.
So there were both kinds of bathhouses.
Yeah, there were both kinds, yes. There was about three or four bathhouses at that time. down on the corner where the Lacey Street Theater is. There was a big one there, Mrs. Wilson ran a bathhouse there.
Mm.
A big steam bath and give massages.
But of course, private homes didn't have baths.
No, very few did. There was a few homes that did have bathrooms, but very few. I don't think it's a dozen really that had the running water and bathrooms because they hadn't perfected a way to run water to the homes. And I know that's how I met Jeff and his mother-in-law was going. That my folks did too, because my dad had the newspaper right there in the Masonic Temple. You see, in the basement, it wasn't the basement, but the Masonic Temple was level on the ground. And what's the dance floor now would have been his printing shop on the level floor.
What, the Masonic College?
Yeah, for the Masonic College today. Yeah, because he moved there after the fire, and he was up on the third or fourth during the fire, and they moved down there after the fire and had the printing shop in there. And that's where he was when Thompson brought him out. And then Thompson moved up to what was the Thompson building, but of course it's gone now. The First National Bank has it at Second and Turner there. Thompson had a building now in Second and Turner, and he moved his newspaper there in the corner for a while. He had paper there on the corner of Second and Turner for a while. He moved there when he first brought out my father. Then he moved up on Third and Cushman, and I don't remember where all he went from there. But my father and this W.F. Thompson that brought him out as a news miner. You see, the news part was my father's part of the paper here, and then W.F. Thompson, in 1909, he brought my father out and made it the news miner, because he had the miner. I think, I thought it was the Dome miner, but somebody said it was a vault or something other than a tenor miner. I don't remember. But anyway, he and my father would walk down there to the town of Tina and to get the news and to print the Tina news for them. They printed that in my father's office, in the Fairbanks Day News office. They printed that. So he talks about walking down the railroad and the mosquitoes, and I know one time he came home and his whole forehead was just chewed alive, but they had mosquito nets on, but he forgot he had little air holes, and the mosquitoes had got their nets or something. They got through the air holes and chewed him across the forehead when they were walking down
there. Well, you said you went down there to dance it.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes, they had a big dance hall over one of the stores down there, and there was quite a little fun between Fairbanks and the town, you know, because the little town of Tina. We would go down there to the dances, and we'd say we're going to the annex or something like that, or they'd come up to the big city, and there was always a lot of fun between the two cities, you know.
Little
competition.
It seems as though this is where we came in, talking about the town of Tina, so we'll leave Clara Rust at this point until our next broadcast, in which we'll continue talking about the woman's side of life in the North Country. As an aside, we'll tell you about the name of W.F. Thompson, the founder of the newspaper, which remains yet today as the leading daily in Fairbanks. In the early days, Thompson was chided about typographical errors in the paper. Apparently, he mixed type styles and sizes. A uniform bank of type is known as a font, so W.F. Thompson was dubbed with the nickname Wrong Font, which he carried until he passed away in the 30s. Clara's father, Mr. Hickman, left Fairbanks for Dawson, where he worked on the Dawson News, then later moved to California. Our interview today has permitted us to know more of the past of Fairbanks and the ways of its early citizens through the understanding eyes of one of Alaska's foremost pioneer ladies. Clara Russ will continue talking about early day Fairbanks in our next interview, along with others who present the viewpoint of women in the North, another in the series, The Sourdough Speak. This is Neville Jacobs inviting you to join us for our next interview with pioneer Alaskans.
You have been listening to The Sourdough Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdough Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services.